Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This begins the fourth week of The Realignment's exclusive focus on the COVID-19 crisis. We started with covering supply chains, the way different areas of the world are affected by this crisis. With Matthew Continetti, we focused on how the realignment itself was being furthered by the implications of the virus, and then we focused on the broader geopolitics of the virus. And finally, this episode, we're really interested in highlighting how, or how not, the U.S.'s overall picture will change when it comes to Asia, when it comes to our southern border, and when it comes to our general force readiness. We're starting off with Walter Russell Mead, who is making his first appearance on this show. Really enjoyed his conversation, very wide-ranging, starting with the impact of the crisis on our southern border. We also took a step back and looked at the overall impact on America's role in the world.
We're happy to welcome back to the show Rebecca Heinrichs. Last time that we spoke, we talked about national security and the broader implications of the Trump administration's their national security outlook, their framework. And this time we're returning to talk about how that outlook, the return of nation states, the way that we look at international organizations, applies to the coronavirus outbreak in particular and the national security implications. To round things out, we bring back Hudson COO John Walters to the show, this time to talk about China. There were some predictions about how China may be leading in the global order after this coronavirus outbreak, and John is here to very much dispel that notion.
And the thing that I just want to emphasize is that these themes that we're focused on at the realignment, everything from industrial policy and the implications of what we make in this country to the fact that ideologies and ideas are changing during this moment, and then sort of finally this sort of greater picture of great power competition with China, all of these things that are highlighted during this crisis, we were focused on them the year before. So I think it's been very harrowing, but very important to note that these themes have just been accelerated by this crisis itself.
And with that, let's get to it.
Walter Russell Mead, welcome to The Realignment.
Good to be here.
So this episode is focused on the broader national security context that COVID-19 is operating under. And you actually wrote a really interesting column at the Wall Street Journal about how we should consider the COVID virus possibly impacting our southern border in terms of Latin American Caribbean outbreaks. What was sort of the context behind that?
Well, if you look at all the things that make all the impact that the virus is having, most of us have been focused so far on its impact in Europe and China and the U.S., but Latin America is actually vulnerable on a whole different level. You've got the economic shock that there's going to be an end to the, tourism has collapsed. Commodity prices have collapsed. The market for exports, Mexican exports to the U.S. has pretty much collapsed. Remittances are going to fall off once, as unemployment spreads among immigrants here in the U.S. They won't be able to send money home to their families. And then there's been a huge shock of capital fleeing emerging markets back to the north. So you put all of those together and it's a huge whammy. But then you also think about the public health implications. I think Mexico has got something like 5,000 ventilators for the entire country, which is less than we have in New York. You have public health systems that are already incredibly overstressed. Some people like to think, that the single payer systems they have in some countries, no one has been paying very much. They don't have the beds, they don't have the equipment. So then you look at places like Venezuela, where already you have kind of civil governance is in a state of collapse. So you got a huge mess on your hands. As I noted in the column too, this is even bad for the drug cartels in that they depend on raw materials. A lot of them come from the parts of China that have been affected. So the production of the precursor chemicals has fallen off. Transit has been shut down across a lot of the Pacific. And then when they try to smuggle them up north with no civil aviation traffic or maritime traffic, it's actually really quite easy to spot drug smuggling. So the drug cartels, which is Latin America's biggest success story of the last decade, are also cut off. You put all of that together, and you have the potential for something much more dramatic than anything we've seen so far in the North.
And so, Walter, when we're adding all of this together and we're looking at so much of what the world looks like, there's a lot of discussion right now in our domestic politics about there will never go be a going back to the coronavirus, you know, the pre-coronavirus status quo. What does that mean maybe in a national security context in terms of the how the United States is going to face problems? What will look different about our problems around the world? And maybe what will be some of the ways that we think about which are the most important and which aren't?
Well, I actually would not underestimate the ability of people to not learn anything from the coronavirus. And, you know, you want to think about it historically. What were the big consequences of the 1918-19 Spanish influenza? It's actually very hard at this point to look back and say, okay, because of the influenza, this changed or that changed. So that's a little tricky to say. One of the things I think I've learned as I've studied history is that one of the things that history teaches you is that on the whole, people don't learn from history. That said, you know, what changes might we see? I mean, I think, you know, the U.S.-China relationship was already undergoing a lot of change. That's probably going to continue. I wouldn't be surprised if the sort of trend toward caution about migration in the U.S. also continues, that there's a sort of a feeling that borders are good things and we're glad we have them. Paradoxically, I think it's going to make life easier for some of the dreamers and undocumented workers / illegal aliens here in the U.S. now, that a lot of these people are actually the people who are delivering groceries and kind of doing all these jobs that we really depend on right now. And it's going to be, I think, politically much harder to say to these folks, we're not going to try to find a way to regularize your situation. So I guess I'd say both toward greater border enforcement and toward a more flexible approach to people who are already here, you're going to see decoupling to some degree from China, which is going to go on. I would not be surprised to see that in the future, when you're getting on an airplane, in addition to all the other kind of checks, there might be a temperature check or something like that. Certainly, the public health part of travel, is people are going to be paying greater attention to.
Walter, something I've appreciated in your previous work is the connection between the domestic policy, especially with economics, and the foreign affairs issues. How do you think we should sort of conceive of that interplay, especially when it comes to the debate about domestic manufacturing of vital medical supplies?
Well, I think you are going to see much more interest being taken in the security of biomedical supply chains. Just to make sure that you know, if something happened and you had a repetition or you had a breakdown of some kind in global communications, we would have we would be able to ramp up production. I don't think that means you're necessarily going to get, you know, sort of, you know, 100% of the medical supplies that we produce we're going to have at home. But I think what you'd be looking at is there some way so that you have a sort of, you know, a basic skeletal ability, and then the ability to move quickly to expand should you need to. One of the interesting things about the International Trading Order is that we have not thought all that much about the security of supply chains in it. The place where you've seen the most is many countries have been incredibly resistant to sort of American pressure to open their markets on agriculture. And the reason is that there are a lot of, you know, that until recently, there are quite a few people in all these countries who remembered what it was like not to have any food for 10 years between sort of the outbreak of World War II and the full restoration of peace, that, you know, you couldn't import wheat from Argentina. And you know, you had a whole generation of Europeans and Japanese grew up who were sort of several inches shorter than their American contemporaries. And so when, you know, when Japan says in World Trade Organization negotiations, no, we want to continue to protect our domestic rice, this is not simply the Japanese government is trying to pander to rice farmers, although, of course, you know, a little bit of pandering is really part of what makes politics work. But it's also, you know, there's a sense that there's a national security. We need to have enough food in our country if everything else breaks down. My guess is that the pandemic is going to refocus a lot of attention on the security consequences for trade. Again, not just in the U.S., but in other countries too.
Yeah, so Walter, what does that mean really for the U.S. trading relationship? Because I think you're absolutely right, which is that there will be a domestic consciousness of American trade, particularly in the biomedical sector and medicines. But if other nations all become, let's say, nationalist in their trade outlook too at the same time, does that mean economic precarity for the United States? What does it mean for multinational organizations like the WTO, the UN? We're already seeing the consequences in the WHO. What does that look like?
Well, in a sense, fortunately, most other countries have been more nationalist than the U.S. in their trading stands and policies. So, and that's that we may not see all that much difference. And the World Trade Organization has basically failed to deliver new trade liberalization for quite some time. And the whole reason that we went we started with these regional trade accords like the Trans-Pacific and the TPIF with Europe was that the attempt for the next round of global trade talks had broken down. So the I think we've already seen that the kind of huge progression toward liberalized trade that we had in the 80s and 90s has kind of run into the ground a bit. This is partly because in trade, like everything else, you pick the low-hanging fruit first. So the first liberalizing trade agreements reaches agreement on all the easy subjects where everybody can see the advantages and there's not a lot of opposition. But then the next round, well, you've already done the easiest things. Now you're looking at harder things. And what we had seen was that it was no longer possible to make real progress on trade on the global WTO side. Then we shifted to these regional agreements, but even the regional agreements have been getting progressively harder to negotiate. So I think the trade agenda is going to be stuck. Now, there are problems with that. It's actually very nice to go to a local Walmart that is incredibly full of really cheap products that come from all over the world. If supply chains are more limited, constricted, and there's more exposure to bottlenecks and so on, we may see some things that your generation has not seen much of, like inflation. You really think about it, that in terms of the kinds of stuff you buy in a store, there has in general been very, very little inflation during the last 15 years, even with very low interest rates, even with quite high consumer demand. That is one of the effects of having, you know, an economically efficient global supply chain system. As we start to make that less efficient, we may get back to the bad old days when every time the economy got going good, the Fed had to step in and stop it before inflation got out of hand. So we've had long expansions, very low unemployment. And we've also seen, of course, rapidly rising wages and standards of living in much of the developing world, which even though the rise of China was not a particularly peaceful event, the fact that billions of people in other countries around the world were finding, you know, increased prosperity through this global trading network, that did contribute rather significantly to peace and progress around the world. So we may see that start to break down too. So it's going to be a very interesting transition as I think we continue to move away a bit from this commitment to global free trade.
I think that's the perfect note to end this section on, this sort of idea that it's not as if COVID-19 is going to change everything, but rather is going to push trends that were already inaugurated post-2016. So, Walter, we really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you again soon.
All right, great.
Thanks for
Have
time,
a good
Walter.
Day. Okay.
Bye. Bye. Walter did such a good job there, not only of tying the domestic political situation here in the United States, but also the international positioning of America in the world and how that intersects with trade in particular. Because so much of what's lost in the discussion right now is a focus on China in particular, without looking at how nations themselves are going to conduct trade in the international system and how the hardening of economic security all around the world could have some paradoxic but interesting effects on the U.S. at large. So to fill in some of the gaps there, we're going to bring in Rebecca Heinrichs to the show. She's returning to talk about the ideology that the Trump administration has always brought to the table and how it looks at the international system and in national security in particular and how that has been affected by the coronavirus crisis. Let's take a listen.
Rebecca Heinrichs, welcome back to The Realignment.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Good to see you again, Rebecca.
Good to see you too.
So we had you on the podcast back in November, and we were really focused on the broad framework that the Trump administration was sort of approaching issues of American leadership and national security with. So obviously a lot has happened since then. COVID-19 is the sort of main thing that we've been focusing on this podcast, on this episode. And I think what would be very helpful is if you could start us off with, how do you think COVID-19 has affected the way the U.S. is approaching the world?
Sure. Well, I think that this is a truly a defining moment. I think people overuse that characterization for too many things, but I think this is really genuinely a defining moment because COVID-19 completely exposes how dangerous it would be and is for countries to outsource critical things that they need for their healthcare to China. It exposes how dangerous the Belt and Road investments are and subscribing to that. You can see that in Italy, for instance, that actually turning over the reins of to China of so much of what your country depends on is actually quite literally bad for your health. And COVID-19, and not only just that, the fact that this came from and originated in China due to what many people at this point believe was the wet market, but that the Chinese government then didn't reveal the information to its own people originally, and then also didn't give the data over to other countries, data that would be necessary about the actual disease so that we could provide responsible and implement responsible actions to protect our own people. And not only that, a lot of, you know, many people in the national security world agree how badly China messed up in the beginning, but there's still disagreement that remains on China's persistent irresponsibility. The Chinese government is still lying about the data and about what they knew when they knew it, and still engaged in this very robust disinformation campaign that they're exploiting to try to gain a strategic advantage over the United States.
And so, Rebecca, one of the things we loved about talking with you last time was not just the specificity of a region, but more about the orientation of American foreign policy. What do you think about the orientation writ large and the themes that are going to be emphasized as a result of this crisis?
So I think so that's a great question. So this, my hope is that the U.S. government under the Trump administration is going to actually have a more united message and effort. So up until this point, you've had the Pentagon that has been very specific that deterring China and to a lesser degree Russia, but those two powers, those two large nuclear powers that have malign intention versus the United States, that we're going to shift what the Pentagon does away from the Middle East, which it has been in counterterrorism efforts and rebuilding democracies. We still have to handle threats from terrorism there, but our focus is going to be geared towards China. And then the State Department has been engaged in trying to show the difference between good allies and partners like the Taiwanese, like Japan, versus the malign activities of the Chinese Communist Party. And Secretary Pompeo has been very clear about the ideological underpinnings of the problem there in China. President Trump has been more narrowly focused on the trade part and the economic problem. And he still, up until this point, has been talking positively about the Chinese government generally, broadly, but this really giving them a hard time on the economic front. I think that this moment is a moment where President Trump needs to take all of these disparate parts of his government and come up with a very clear message to take to the American people that says, we are actually engaged in a competition for primacy. Will the United States acquiesce its sovereignty and the care of its people over to China in all of these variety of ways that we're seeing now in terms of supply lines, supply chains of what we need to pharmaceuticals and different therapeutic elements that we need to care for our people? Do we let China have those? And it's not just economic, but it's also military and hard power and all these other different things. And that is something that President Trump, I think, really needs to put a bow on at this point, that the American people, Republicans and Democrats, regardless of where you are on the president himself, do not think that it makes any sense at this point to try to have a spirit of cooperation or an amicability between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, that we really are in this competition against one another and not with each other.
Yeah, and I think one of building on that, one of the most important ideas that I think has always been true, but people didn't really have in their conceptual toolbox, is the idea that biodefense is a really important part of our national security. So that leads us into the WHO, sort of the World Health Organization. This organization, you know, we have these sort of fights over international organizations every few years, but I don't think anyone, whether they're on the right or the left, were bringing the WHO into those debates. Like, what do you think about that topic? President Trump expressed some skepticism over it, all that sort of stuff.
So this is the WHO problem perfectly shows why President Trump's instincts on distrusting international organizations and trusting the security of the United States with the United States and not trusting international bodies primarily. It has been right that it's not just, it's international organizations, it's treaties, that just having a bunch of different countries working supposedly together is not in and of itself enough. That the United States has to constantly be looking to make sure that it's actually furthering and securing American interests. The WHO has become a mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party. And President Trump is exactly right in withholding funds until further notice from the WHO because of how badly it has botched the handling of COVID-19, about how badly it has treated the Taiwanese government when Taiwan has actually really been a great ally and partner of the United States in treating, you know, the COVID issue seriously and incompetently and humanely. And so not to say that there is room for international cooperation and for partnerships. And this is why the Trump administration is not isolationist, contrary to what critics would have us believe. It's just that we have to, perhaps maybe even here's an opportunity to start a new organization that actually sets standards for what it would require to enter into it. And so that it rewards responsible behavior that we can trust, because in the past we have, there's been this bipartisan misconception that if you just let all of these authoritarian countries into these organizations that they will liberalize over time. And that is not true, because people and countries are not always primarily motivated by economics. We're motivated by all these disparate things, ideologies, ethnic considerations for some countries, including the Chinese, and religious and all these other different motivations. And so you have to take the nature of these regimes into account and how they behave before you give them the privilege of being part of these international organizations like the WHO.
Yeah, Rebecca, and this is something we spent a lot of time talking about the last time you were on here, which is about the, both the nature of these regimes and how we look at the way that we incorporate them into our international institutions. I think we talked a little bit about the Iran deal. But with China in particular, as we think about this, how are we supposed to craft our kind of international strategy and the way that we build our alliances? Should it be ideological based? Should it be purely on the basis of our of the needs, like our economic relationships? How should we be thinking about alliances in the post-coronavirus crisis?
Well, I mean, I think at this point, I absolutely think that it's essential to look at our look at those countries that are seeing what China has been up to and is willing to corner, isolate might be a too strong of a word, but definitely separate from and disentangle itself from the Chinese government. So I think because that is the primary problem, I think, facing the United States, we should look across the world, but in particular, those most deeply affected by the behavior of the Chinese Communist Party, and work with them. And so I'm not one of these that is trying to, let me put it this way. I'm not advocating for a freedom agenda part two, where we are now, but that was the Bush administration's mission to go out and try to make democracies of the world. That would not be a fruitful exercise. I think that our standard for the countries that would make partners and allies in this particular mission should be those who recognize the very serious danger of China and then are willing to work with the United States to come up with a better system of a partnering and aligning with one another, if that makes sense. So I don't think that we should cast aside countries that don't necessarily, I don't think we should be beating up countries over the head if they aren't meeting all of the liberal democratic standards that we would want. But we do have to have a modicum of trust between those who are understanding the threat of the Chinese Communist Party and who are at least trying to have more responsible, transparent behavior for us to be able to have these kinds of partners. The Pentagon had this, there's this idea that we should have a Pacific deterrence initiative or defense initiative, where you basically partner with other countries around China to have stronger alliances and defense alliances so that we can, together with sovereign countries, better deter and defend against Chinese military provocations. I definitely think that's something that the Pentagon should be working with the State Department and the White House and National Security Council to get off the ground.
Yeah, and Rebecca, thank you for coming on. I think there's been one really key theme here. It's that if we're thinking about the national security implications of this crisis and how we should look at the world going forward, is that there's this defining trend, which is this competition between the U.S. and China. How in a lot of ways these issues are really zero sum, which is actually the perfect lead-in to our conversation next with John Walters, who really centers things around China the same way you did.
If I could say one last thing too, China at Davos gave this, the Xi Jinping tried to characterize the Chinese government with him at the helm as the leader of globalism, and that the United States, with this return of an appreciation for the nation and that nations must engage and must primarily defend and prioritize their own countries, and then partner with those where they have shared interests, and understand that with the United States as a preeminent power, that's a much better way to go for them. That Xi Jinping tried to characterize it without specifically mentioning President Trump, though, as a choice between this great vision of China as the leader of globalism, multilateralism, and of an open world in which there's, you know, the free commerce and you know, with China as the world's global leader. And the COVID-19 pandemic completely exposes what a nightmarish scenario that would be. But on a much smaller scale, what we're seeing with COVID-19, you can imagine a much more serious disease or a variety of other problems that would occur. But with China as the one who has, you know, all of the supplies, healthcare supplies, you know, the Chinese government has been, like in the case of Australia, they bought up all of these healthcare supplies necessary for combating COVID early on, when only the Chinese government understood how bad the situation was. And now as hoarding it and then turning around and selling supplies to other countries. That's one example. You have the one of the newspaper organizations that is an arm of the Chinese government threatening to withhold supplies that the United States would need to plunge the United States into coronavirus, into the disaster of coronavirus, paraphrasing. So you can see how actually it would not be this great place in which China is the guardian of the security of people and of open spaces, shared spaces, common spaces, and these multilateral architectures, that it would be a terrible world in which you are under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party and under constant fear of being coerced and, you know, being so vulnerable to the whims of the CCP. And so that, I think, is a message that I hope that the U.S. government would develop more and point out that this is what's at stake. And both Republicans and Democrats should get behind this and understand that we need to have an across the government understanding of how we are engaged in this competition against China for American sovereignty, so that we can engage in the world on our own terms and provide optimal protection of our people, and that we're not reliant on the whims and the coercion of the CCP.
Well, it's such an excellent point, Rebecca. And I think the fact that the Chinese wanted to be the leaders of globalism tells you a little bit about who globalism was benefiting in the long run. And that's something that we're going to explore a lot more with John Walters, our next guest. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Really appreciate being here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming. Great. John Walters, welcome back to the Realignment for your third appearance.
Great to be with you guys. You do great work. Thanks.
Good to see you, John.
Yeah, thank you. And I would say you do great work as well, too. Well, speaking of great work, we reached out to you because you wrote a recent op-ed that was in the Wall Street Journal that was discussing sort of how there's this really strange phenomenon, how a lot of people have sort of taken the COVID-19 crisis to signify that the Chinese authoritarianism is somehow better equipped to confront that sort of system versus democracy. So it'd be great, I think, for our audience if you could just sort of open up with what were you thinking when you sort of wrote that piece?
Well, I think there was a narrative starting of one that, dictatorships are better or oligarchies are better than democratic governments, and that China was somehow going to win. Now, this has been a kind of theme of, you know, it's a big country, it's growing, it's going to inevitably rewrite the world order. And a lot of that is I think, ignorant, not looking at the details of what
is tenuous in the structure of the Chinese regime, but also not looking at the strengths of America and the free democratic countries that are in the world. That, you know, we have the strength, even though we fight about politics. We have a government that can correct itself. We have innovation. We have considerable wealth that this kind of structure have free market economies have created. So one, it's to get people to rethink, you know, what the real facts are on the ground of Chinese weakness and free nation strengths, but also to understand a little bit about, you know, what's going to happen from here when the some of the manifest weaknesses of the Chinese political structure are really thought of in terms of the global harm that's been done by this epidemic.
So, John, let's dig into that a little bit, because one of the things that you first talk about is how some people are actually even saying that China will emerge from the crisis as a stronger global power and that the U.S. will actually need its help to recover. Why do you think that that's actually the other way around? Why is that kind of upside down?
Well, first, I have a very, very good colleague at Hudson, John Lee, who's written two reports about the financial weakness of the Chinese economy and how dangerously positioned it is right now, that has been overlooked. Some people have talked about it, but in the quest for Chinese markets, it's been I think we've been a little too blind to that. So there's a great weakness that's growing and is difficult for them to fix, because they'd have to change the structure of their political order, which they will not do. The party will not do. The other part of it, I think, is that what you're seeing in all this is people now thinking about. And increasingly, this brings to a head the problems that were being talked about more and more since President Trump's administration about the problems of doing business with China. They're not only more aggressive in the national security realm, but they're predatory in business. They're thieves of intellectual property. They are aggregators of parts of the supply chain. We've talked now about pharmaceuticals in particular, but other parts of critical elements that governments need. All that is going to produce a pulling back. I don't think there's any question. You already see calls for this in a variety of places that, you know, hey, we have to have more national integrity. I mean, nationalism to some degree is getting a big boost out of this. And that's partly because people are turning to who they can trust and what they have relationships with that are politically connected and reliable. And those are nations. They're not the globe. They're not China. They're not even the EU, I think. And that's a problem for Europe.
I think what was interesting about, and you cited this in the piece, it isn't just sort of, I think, members of the press or sort of people who are sort of not particularly sympathetic to the U.S. who are making the claim about China's effectiveness. It's the World Health Organization. So there are international institutions that are really lauding this Chinese response. How does, how do you really think of the WHO during this current crisis? And what does that broadly say about the way that we have to interact with international organizations going forward?
Well, I think what we've learned here is if we really need an international organization, they have the current structure in many ways has to be reformed, including the World Health Organization. We don't have people, but this has been part of what we've talked about with regard to trade and WTO. We had things that were supposed to be rules-based, that were supposed to be professional, that were supposed to be able to act across government jurisdictions, and they're not working. They're not enforcing rules. They're not dealing with problems. They're looking the other way. They're being captured politically. China has now clearly exploited these organizations systematically to bend them to its will and not be a good faith international player. We have to deal with that. And I think that's what you're going to see after people get back on their feet here after the epidemic is you're going to see a change, a radical change of a different way of doing business with China, of expectations, of enforcement of rules that have been allowed to drift and not be enforced. And that's going to be a problem for China, which is already, I repeat, economically weaker than many people realized. I think you're already seeing reports that the current leadership is seeing cracks, and I would not be surprised if that continues under the current circumstance.
Right, so John.
it's only one way this trend's going, and it's not in China's favor.
John, I mean, the story you're telling about international organizations, no secret, I think, to anybody who listens to this podcast. But one of the things that you also laid out there about international organizations can also, I think, be really aptly applied to American policy over the last 30 years. So before we get into what exactly the future will look like, what are the gaps in American policy that have been revealed as maybe suboptimal in terms of what we have to come to a reckoning with before we can fix it going forward in terms of our relationship with China, in terms of our domestic manufacturing base, and so much of the way that we think about our economy?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, the national government has to protect the nation. So national security is a primary issue, and we're going to rethink our relationship with the greatest, single security challenge, China, and we're going to rethink some of our alliances. But domestically, I think what you see is a challenge to the structure of what we like to call federalism, the effort to try to solve problems or defer problems to various levels of government. There's a problem in coordinating that. And when they get overwhelmed, you have a problem with who's managing what. Increasingly, what you see here, of course, is the federal government being accountable for, deploying material resources, deploying military resources, planning. But what we can do now, what we'll probably do more of, I believe, inevitably here, is we're going to have more use of technology and data to track things like disease, to track things like material need in places. We are a country. And while we want individual communities to have integrity even more than they do now, when we have too much nationalization in one sense and not enough nationalization in another, but we're also going to have institutions that we rethink. How do we want to divide the labor between levels of government in a way? I actually think that the best way to do this is more information about what's happening in hospitals, healthcare centers, in schools, in employment, in public safety, so that people locally can see how they compare and to know ahead of time what's happening. That is granular information that they then are given an opportunity to act on, so it's not all being sucked into a national authority, but also that the national authority can be aware of when there's a breakdown that may affect a larger region or even the country, in the case of disease, or in the case of things like drug trafficking, or in the case of things like real economic hardship. Right now, we have a lot of information, but it's not organized. And I really think there's a real opportunity here to think about using the new information management tools we have, AI, other kinds of data, in a way that creates a manageable set of information that people can understand and that can be transparent between leaders and citizens.
I think something that's interesting for me is the emerging conversation, which you referenced in your piece, around the U.S.'s inability to meet its basic medical needs. So obviously, it's pretty straightforward to sort of bring that discussion into basic national security needs. And especially when we're talking about the right, there's this, like you said, that there's this broad acceptance of the idea that the federal government is responsible for basic defense. But it starts to get a little murky when that sort of starts spilling over into issues such as masks and ventilators. So how should we sort of on a broader philosophical level, especially coming from the right, think about that issue?
Well, in this case, you have a classic case of a large impact in it, intermittent or even remote threat. How do you reportion resources for that? I think what you are going to see more of is something that we actually been working at Hudson with the Defense Department on, which is creating flexibility in the industrial base and in the business structure of the United States to handle ramp ups that are quick. You've seen this with like flu season. Obviously, this is a catastrophic increase in the amount of threat here. But obviously, we want to be able to do things like better produce tests, produce equipment for healthcare workers, to produce vaccines. And I think all that is obviously going to get a scrub here because nobody's going to want to go through this again. The other part of this, obviously, that is international, that remains obvious but not, I think, adequately talked about, is I believe China's opening up these wet markets again. Why do we have an annual flu threat from Asia that the World Health Organization, the one thing you would think it would be able to kind of do here is get to the bottom of why is that happening and start cutting off that risk at the source. But the other part of this is to create a flexible industrial base using the technological tools that are even more robust today than they were for preparing for World War II, and be able to have that flexibility built in. I think this is a wake-up call of the necessity of still doing that. And you know, as Dr. Fauci has said, we're not having to use the most crude tools of remediation, where what you want to be able to do is identify outbreaks quickly, limit them at the point of smallest occurrence, isolate, treat, and quarantine individuals. Now you're trying to shut whole nations down because you can't do the kind of precise response that you'd like to do. We ought to go back to doing a better job on precise response, and I think that's one of the imperatives that'll come out of this.
And so, John, I mean, what we focused on now is really about what the coronavirus crisis has revealed about our relationship with China, about China and the way that it's able to manipulate international institutions and kind of broader failures in U.S. policy in the past. So in terms of not just the way that we think about pandemic policy, but the way that we should think about economic policy, about global trade, about the very like most important parts of our economy, what do you think those lessons are that you can extrapolate from your piece broadly and some of the work at Hudson? What are some of the overarching priorities that we're going to have as we approach trade from the experience of what we've learned throughout this crisis?
Well, I suggested we go back and when we think about what's going to happen afterwards is we remember our strengths. Our strengths are a democratic society. Our strengths are innovative thinking. Our strengths are our freedom and the resources that we've built, industrial, intellectual, political. We look at the day-to-day fighting in our politics, but we have a politics that allows an amazing diversity of opinions, and it hashes them out in a not-so-pretty way. I mean, many people have commented on democracy is ugly. It's just the best thing we've been able to come up with. And we ought not to forget that in the days ahead. I do think that what we ought to do is reinforce those strengths. We ought to reinforce democracy. We ought to expect there to be rough and tumble speech and criticism and everything else that we find ugly in some cases, and it is ugly in some cases, but we ought to remember that ultimately the free speech is about the way in which free people hash out differences and come up with new solutions. I mean, your own program is talking about people with different voices and points of view trying to figure out which argument is better. And we ought to let people, I think we need more ability of citizens to decide the future of their country and not just have that dictated by others, as you see in the extreme case in China. And the other is, I think we got to go back and think about our own capacity to use innovation and independence here, both in our education structure, which is becoming a little monolithic and a little too doctrinaire, to say the least, and also to look at the capacity of the United States to really be a leader here. We're going to come out of this as the stronger nation, frankly, despite all the naysayers. We're going to be the ones people look to. No one, I mean, there's a horrifying future potentially here for Latin America, Africa, some of the other countries in Asia that do not have the resources to do public funding to both protect and to rebuild institutions that could be damaged in the ongoing path of this epidemic. So we're gonna have demands on our resources, but more so well demands on our example. I think all of the discussion of the strength and weakness of China comes down to one point in my mind. The communist regime in China is unjust. It's so weak that if the president of the United States tweeted out several times that the communist regime in China is unjust, it doesn't represent the people, and it is not a democracy or an acceptable form of government in a free world, that would be a staggering blow to China. Not because it's rhetoric, but because everybody knows it's true. That's the weakness at the core of the Chinese regime and every other oligarchic and predatory regime on the planet. That's the fundamental strength of free government and of the United States. And I think we ought to remember that. Now, I'm not saying we should go out and just name call, but occasionally we need to be more forthright in saying, this is what justice is. This is why people thrive. These are the principles we believe in. And when they're violated, it's not just relativism. It's about the future of human beings and the kind of world we're going to live in. And I think that's a measure of real leadership that you don't see enough in international organizations. Frankly, we haven't seen it enough in some of the United States leadership. You can criticize Donald Trump for a number of things, as people have and will in the future. But the one thing that he's kind of insisted on is the example of the United States. He's not giving the Gettysburg Address, but he's kind of pointing to what people know about the United States and calling that forward. And that's important. That's in the tradition of Reagan. And to some extent, that's also in the tradition of Lincoln.
And John, to wrap things up, I think my last question is, are we ever going to sort of go back to the period before January 2020? I think people have compared the sort of moment right now to sort of there was before 9/11 and there was after 9/11. There was before the 2008 financial crisis. There was after. Obviously, I'm not trying to make light of any of those, you know, horrific experiences, but it really just seems like this is another one of these sort of age-defining experiences. And I'm curious how you think about that framework.
Well, as we're speaking, I don't know how far the virus will go in the world as well as in the United States, although it looks like there are some signs now, thank God, that there's a lessening of the extent of the infection. We'll see. I mean, we don't know enough about how this can go through cycles and so forth. But if you take the example of, you know, the worst things in recent history, maybe not so recent history, World War II, other wars the United States has fought, 9/11. The United States has come back, and it's come back stronger. And I think the world has, you know, look, there's been a lot of studies done about, you know, poverty in the world and you know, ups and downs of free governments in the world. And the trend has been, for the most part, good. I think recently with the Chinese effort and frankly the oligarchic forms of kleptocratic regimes, some of which work we're doing at Hudson, that's a problem we need to deal with. But I don't think the fundamentals of the United States' strength are going to be destroyed or in any long term weakened by this. If the epidemic is shorter, that is a few months rather than 2 years, then I would think that a lot of the structures that, you know, have people haven't been destroyed in large numbers, institutions, infrastructure. So that will come back and people will want to come back. There'll be more energy. I think that's right. There could be a more of a V-shaped recovery, as some people predict. If it takes longer, it will take longer, but I do think that the relative strength of the United States in the world is going to be greater, not lesser. And I do think the United States has the fundamentals and has a new impetus to deal with some problems it hasn't dealt with before in terms of both equity and I think in terms of some of these other issues of institutions doing a better job to protect health and well-being of Americans.
With that very optimistic message, and I think an important one, John, thank you so much for joining us at The Realignment. We really always appreciate your voice here.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you, John.
Of course. Thanks for joining the episode. We hope you enjoyed it. One of the things that we really want to make sure that you all take away from this is that the realignment, while it's been happening in the shadows, maybe not so much for quite some time, is that with the coronavirus crisis, while the world may have seemed like it's hit paused, what it's really done is revealed the fault lines of our society, the fault lines of the international system, and it's accelerated trends that we've talked about here on the show, which is that the international order and the way that America looks at itself in the world has changed. The way and our relationship with China was brought to a question in 2016, but is now really a matter of existentialism for the United States. And just the way that we talk about economic security as a country is going to be different now for decades to come. And I hope that you're all understanding that that's the message that we've been trying to bring you from the very beginning of the day that we started this podcast.
Yeah, and what I've enjoyed in all of our conversations over the past month is the idea that COVID-19 isn't creating anything new. All these trends we're focused on here, everything from our domestic manufacturing capacity to brewing great power competition with China, debates about what the government's role is, especially within the conservative movement, all that's been there for a while, and those trends have just been accelerated. So I think what's been so helpful for the past year is we've been able to think about these trends so that we're able to bring them right into this coronavirus context. And I think Sagar and I are really excited to keep doing that moving forward, because we're just going to continue to see that every single day.
That's right. So we're just getting started here, folks, and we will be back with you next week here on The Realignment. Please make sure you subscribe or rate 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week.